the death of an African economic rebel.
And Syrian entrepreneurs take their skills with them as they flee the conflict. Hello, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. It is Tuesday, August 21st. We'll talk about the economic legacy of Ethiopia's prime minister who has just died. And we're going to talk about a new Mayo Clinic study showing that our doctors are way more stressed out than the rest of us. Which kind of doctors are the most stressed out? Stacey, that actually turns out to be a little surprising.
Really? Very intrigued.
Stay tuned.
And also, as President Obama gets tough with Syria this week, a lot of residents are fleeing and they are taking their entrepreneurial skills with them to neighboring Turkey.
That's coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Today, the global economy is taking some note of a country it doesn't often pay much mind to, Ethiopia. The country's leader since 1991 has died. Meles Zenawi was just 57, so people weren't expecting this. He faced criticism for civil and human rights abuses in recent years, but he also got credit for a remarkable run of economic growth in Ethiopia. Michael Jennings is chair of the Center of African Studies at the University of London. Good to talk with you.
Hello, thank you.
It is heavily dated, I'll admit, but many Americans' impressions of Ethiopia are probably still linked to the 80s. We are the world, you know, and images of famine. How has the country changed during Meles' 20 years in power?
Well, I think that people visiting, would be surprised by how Ethiopia has changed. That old image of a country hit by famine, if it was ever true, certainly isn't now. And in terms of economics, Ethiopia has been, or is heralded as one of the success stories of sub-Saharan Africa. The region as a whole, over the past decade, has seen some quite significant economic growth, and Ethiopia has been at the forefront of that. So it's benefited from inward investment, it's encouraged commercial agriculture, it's expanded its exports of certain key commodities. So it's on the face of it, it looks like it's doing pretty well and has continued to do so.
As I understand it, Meles's approach to economic policy was not exactly unfettered free market capitalism. How would you characterize it?
I think there has been a transition by Zenawi. I mean, I think he started off as a Marxist, but over the past two decades has transformed to perhaps something more akin to state capitalism. It is not unfettered capitalism, but neither could it really be characterized as socialism, certainly not Marxism.
Michael Jennings at the University of London, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Clicking over to the markets here, Stacey, looks like a mixed close in Asia. Nothing too much happening there with stock markets. Europe, though, is heading toward a higher close at this hour, and the U.S.
good
as
day
well.
In Europe.
And the U.S. is off to a good start. The NASDAQ up 0.5%. S&P 500 also up 0.5%, and the Dow up about 0.33%. However, it is a bad day, once again, for Best Buy, which slid 10% yesterday on the day that they announced their new CEO. Always a good sign. And their share price is down more than 3% so far again today. Best Buy said second quarter profits fell to almost nothing. Same store sales dropped 3%. That's never good. Gives you some sense of the turnaround that's facing the new CEO when he takes over next month.
And an estimated 170,000 Syrians have now fled fighting between government and opposition forces. Tens of thousands have ended up in neighboring Turkey. Many of those Syrian refugees have brought their entrepreneurial skills with them. From the Turkey-Syria border, here's reporter Reese Ehrlich.
Mohammed Jundi walks towards the refugee camp where he's lived for the past 15 months, ever since he fled his hometown in central Syria.
The Syrian military bombed my city. We were demonstrating peacefully, then the military came, shelled the city, and slaughtered some civilians. We had to get out.
Surrounded by fellow refugees, Jundi explains that back home, he ran a small business.
I had a restaurant, but it was completely destroyed as revenge against my family because of our anti-Assad protests.
Jundi is putting his skills to work in the Yayladagi camp. He's turned his tent into a falafel stand. He says he and others here are grateful for the free meals the Turkish aid groups provide, but nothing compares with a good Syrian falafel sandwich. And here, as elsewhere, business has its challenges.
In Antakya, the closest big city, the prices for garbanzo and other ingredients are normal. But in the nearby village here, sometimes they gouge us on prices.
At a grocery in that nearby town, owner Mukhtar Yashar is raking it in. Yashar denies gouging the Syrians, but admits that some local merchants make a lot of money off the refugees. Business is up 70%. That's why people in this small rural town fought to keep the camp open when Turkey's government considered closing it down a few months ago.
I don't want the war in Syria to continue just because of business. But if the war ends, my business will go way down. We want the refugees here.
The Turkish government has moved thousands of refugees to other camps in Turkey, but some 3,500 remain here. And several thousand more enter Turkey every week. In Yayladagi, Turkey, I'm Reese Erlich for Marketplace.
Here in the U.S., our doctors are stressed out, Stacey, apparently.
They should try paying their bills.
Well, there has been...
That stresses me out.
The reaction to this story is not entirely positive. You're right. Burned out, actually, is the clinical term in a new study from the Mayo Clinic, and it claims to be the first extensive look at burnout and work-life balance among physicians. One headline from it is that 38% of doctors are certifiably burned out. And that compares to 28% of the general working public. Dr. Tate Schoenefeldt is the lead author. He's a professor of medicine at Mayo. Good to talk with you.
Thank you, Jeff.
As far as this study is concerned, how do you measure if a doctor is burned out?
Well, there are some standardized survey instruments, and some of the key symptoms that they explore are what we call emotional exhaustion or losing your enthusiasm for your work, depersonalization, which means treating people or as if they're objects rather than human beings, and having a low sense of meaning or purpose in your work.
Now, I would guess that the most stressed out doctors are surgeons or ER doctors, people in life or death situations, very uncomfortable working conditions. What did you find?
Well, and that was our hypothesis going into the study as well. And indeed, we did find that the emergency room doctors had the highest rates of burnout. But I think one of the striking findings of the study was that several of the other specialties at highest risk were the family physicians and the general internal medicine physicians, both of whom had burnout rates right around 50%, or one out of every two physicians. And that's particularly concerning since those specialties are really the front door of access to the medical care system for most people.
Looking at some initial reaction to the study online this morning, there are plenty of folks saying, you know, cry me a river, doctors. You chose to be a doctor. Most of you make a pretty good living. The public trust we give you, upholding the Hippocratic Oath, it's not supposed to be easy. What do you say to that?
Well, I think the burnout in the physicians is important for a couple reasons. Over the last decade, we've seen a number of studies demonstrating associations between burnout and quality of care, indicating that physicians with higher degrees of burnout are at greater risk of making medical errors. We've also seen that when physicians experience burnout, they often respond by either pursuing early retirement or cutting back the number of hours they work to provide clinical care for patients, both of which have important implications for the adequacy of the physician workforce, precisely at a time we're trying to bring 30 to 40 million uninsured individuals into the system, and when we're already looking at physician shortages in many specialties, including a number of those with the highest rates of burnout.
Dr. Tate Schoenefeldt, lead author of the Physician Burnout Study, thanks very much.
You bet. Thank you.
And by the way, Stacey, for all of the stress, all of the burnout, one thing that physicians do not need to be too afraid of is job security.
Well, that's good.
Yep, we have a feature up on our website. It's called the Future Jobs-O-Matic, if folks haven't checked it out. It'll give you a forecast for where any job you might want to investigate might put you 10 years from now. Is it going to pay well? How's the hiring going to be? So we checked physicians and surgeons. They are, of course, among the very highest paid jobs, and they have a predicted growth in jobs numbers of 24%. Between 2008 and 2018. So among the strongest performers in the Future Jobs-O-Matic, check out lots of other jobs by checking it out yourself at marketplace.org.
And speaking of the most challenging job you could ever have being a parent, am I right, Jeff?
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
I'm not actually a parent, but this is what I hear.
Yes.
Anyway, for parents, it is back to school shopping season. Have you gotten started on this at all, Jeff?
No, not yet. My son's going into pre-K. We talked about this yesterday. You told me I might need a graphing calculator for him. So we're going shopping.
Well, you might need a luxury graphing calculator, actually. Okay. Apparently, despite the weak economy, luxury retail has been doing really well. And luxury kids' clothing is also doing really well. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Shireen Marisol Meraji has that story for us.
Gucci's been designing kids' clothes for 2 years now. So I took a trip to its store on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills.
And how old are you?
Inside, the kids' section was pretty small, just a few racks and shelves. A six-year-old was trying on a pair of $200 sneakers before her first day of school, but it was the tiny camel-colored leather jacket with the $1,700 price tag that screamed luxury.
The designer and upper-end market has grown from 3% of the total kids' business to what now will become 6 to 8% by the end of 2012.
Marshall Cohen is the chief retail analyst with NPD Group. He says Oscar de la Renta has a new kids line out this fall, and you can expect to see more high-end designers outfitting kids in the future. Cohen says it's all about getting kids connected to luxury
and addicted to it. And as they grow older, you create some kind of loyalty and long-term customer relationships.
Gucci's gateway drug? Perhaps it's $275 ice gray skinny jean for 6 to 12-year-old girls. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
And, Jeff, speaking of high price tags, Nike is releasing its most expensive sneaker ever, the LeBron X Nike Plus.
Sure.
It's going to cost $315.
Right. Does it come in a size that will fit a four-year-old?
I bet it does.
Because I want him to be able to dunk.
Well, actually, to that end, it includes a sensor, the shoe does, that measures how high you jump. Hmm. So you can
so like
get
four,
him
4 inches in his case.
That's right. And Nike also is raising its general prices for shoes and clothes by 5 to 10%. The company is blaming that on the rising cost of materials like cotton.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Around 100 boats and barges are awaiting passage in the Mississippi River this morning. An 11-mile stretch of the river has been closed. It's because of low water levels. The Midwestern drought has hurt many companies that ship goods down the Mississippi. And that has many industries taking a closer look at where their water comes from. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, here's Eve Trow.
To turn crude oil into car-ready gas, you need a lot of water. How much? Well, your shower uses about 3 gallons a minute. The vast BP oil refinery in South Los Angeles uses thousands of gallons a minute, 24 hours a day.
You can see it looks like it's raining inside there.
That's kind of a torrential downpour.
Senior engineer Ken Letwin shows me one of the giant towers where water sprays down to cool chemical vapor into liquid gasoline. This plant was built in the 1920s, when Southern California was bursting with water.
You just poked a hole in the ground, pretty much any place water came out.
But BP's wells have mostly run dry, so it switched to tap water, the same stuff people drink. Now, the state has a goal to cut back on that water by 20% in the next few years. Ken Letwin says using 20% less water at oil refineries would mean
reduction in gasoline production and a spike in prices.
He says cutting back's not an option, but using different water is.
The sewage water that's being treated and pumped out into the ocean is a very, very large supply.
A local water agency now diverts some of that water on its way to the sea and sends it to BP.
In that cooling tower right there, about 75% of it is recycled water.
BP pays a bit more for this recycled water. Worth it for the secure supply. Since no one else needs it, no agency will tell the company to use less of it. Lots of industries that rely on water are also shoring up their sources.
Power generation, oil and gas, mining, semiconductor manufacturing, pharmaceuticals, chemicals, and food and beverage companies.
That's Zoe Cholik-Antich with the Carbon Disclosure Project, a nonprofit that tracks environmental risk for business. She says water risk doesn't show up in, say, stock price or earnings, because right now it's so cheap.
the cost of water doesn't really reflect its true value to business.
To get companies to value water, she says, you have to get them thinking, what would happen if the tap ran dry? I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
And Jeff, Apple has hit a major milestone this week.
Ta-da.
It's now the biggest public company ever measured by stock value.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
Nicely done.
Its stock went up more than 2.5% yesterday, and the company is now worth $616 billion. Joining us now to talk a little more about this is our own Scott Tong in Washington. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Stacey.
So, Scott, how big of a deal is this?
Well, compared to today's competition, Apple is looking in the rearview mirror, and it can hardly see it. Last year, Apple nosed ahead of ExxonMobil, which is number two. Now, Apple is worth 1.5 ExxonMobils. So you knew there was a however to it, and here it is. Historically speaking, if you would adjust for inflation, Microsoft back in 1999 was bigger. I spoke this morning to Howard Silverblatt at Standard & Poor's. He says the Apple stock now costs $665 to buy one share. To pass Microsoft back in the day, it would have to zoom up to 910.
Apple this year is up over 60% already. So if you find someone who bought it, let them buy dinner.
Let them buy dinner. By the way, Stacey, we do have a cool Apple stock chart up on our website, marketplace.org. It, as you can imagine, looks like a hockey stick.
Well, Scott, give us an idea of how the hockey stick got started. How did Apple get here?
By charging a lot of money for their stuff. I mean, by one guesstimate, it costs maybe $200 in material and labor to make a smartphone. Samsung marks it up to maybe $400. Apple marks it up to $600. So a lot of this story is a profit margin story.
Hmm. And can Apple keep this up? They did report disappointing earnings last month, if I remember right.
Well, that is right. So if you're a half full kind of person, you say, this is just the lull before the next must-have Apple product, the iPhone 5. Longer view, nobody stays on top forever. Just ask General Motors or Sony or Woolworth.
Scott Tong in Washington. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
Walmart.com, Stacey, recently featured a deal that seems too good to be true. The math doesn't work out for this.
$80,
you could buy a $100 gift card for Apple's iTunes.
That's fantastic.
Yes.
I want that gift card.
Well, it's out of stock now because obviously it was very attractive to people. But just what was going on there? Well, Marketplace's Jeff Tyler got curious. And it turns out it's a further indication that the value in gift cards goes beyond that number that's stamped on the front.
When consumers buy a prepaid gift card, the merchant also gets a present. Ben Jackson is an analyst with the Mercator Advisory Group.
It's a way for them to lock in future sales. And we know, too, that gift cards are often a license to spend. So somebody comes in with a $50 gift card, and they'll end up spending $75 or $100 with that store.
Okay, but why do grocery and drug stores sell gift cards that can only be redeemed at other retailers? Brian Riley is Senior Research Director with CEB Tower Group.
So the retailer, say, a $100 gift card might be charging its distributor 92 cents on the dollar. And so you have that 8% margin, which would get translated into commissions along the way.
Some businesses will eat that commission in order to provide customers with discounted gift cards. That's how Walmart can sometimes charge $80 for a gift card worth $100 at iTunes. The difference is considered the cost of attracting new customers. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
And Jeff, you can forget Easy Rider. Harley Davidson is more interested in Holy Rider. The motorcycle company has announced.
What does that mean?
Well, the motorcycle company has just announced its bikes will be getting a blessing from Pope Benedict XVI at the Vatican next year. It is part of Harley-Davidson's 110th anniversary.
Wow.
I don't know if he's blessing all of the bikes or just some of them. I would imagine just some of them, but it probably rubs off
papal
blessings.
I know there's a Pope Mobile. Is there a Pope Hog with a big glass bubble on it?
There needs to be.
That would be
there needs
something.
To be.
Well, speaking of religion, very loosely, I guess, if you or anybody else has ever wanted to drink alcohol and donate to charity at the same time, aside from silent auctions, I guess, there is now a place to do that. And we're going to have a little guessing game here for you and the folks
okay.
at home. Guess which major American city gave birth to this concept. The pastor of a free-spirited local church is about to open a pub that includes a menu of local craft beers and a menu of charities to donate the profits from your pint. And the so-called Philanthropub is going to open later this year. You have any guesses?
I was thinking Las Vegas, because if anyone's going to combine drinking and church, it seems, you know, most appropriate that it would be Vegas.
Yes, although I think people in Vegas are very busy giving their money away to the casinos
rather than
charities.
The alcohol's free there.
But if you or anybody else had thought Portland, Oregon, if you've ever seen Portlandia, or been to Portland, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yes.
Ding, 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 ding. You are correct. What a perfectly Portland concept. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. And this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.